It's Friday. I'm John Zogby with my son, Jeremy. And this is now our 75th podcast, which is great. And we've been having a lot of fun with it. And we're going to have fun today as well. Good morning, Jer. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. You know, I was just thinking that I was a teacher for 10 years, and I've been in this business with you for 5 years, and we've been doing this podcast for a year. And you would think that at some point it wouldn't be nerve-wracking at all, but it's just a little bit nerve-wracking. But I think that's what keeps me hooked. So,
well, I think one further dimension is that I generally don't know what we're going to talk about. I've kind of cultivated that until at best an hour before, usually right before we turn the cameras on. And then you especially have no idea where I'm coming from. And so this is what's popped into my head. And I hope it'll be lively. So Jeremy, you already know that in 2003, I conducted a poll with a very conservative fellow by the name of Brad O'Leary and a very liberal fellow and good friend, both of them, John White, professor of political science at Catholic University of America. And what we did was we took the artificial construct that emerged from the 2000 elections. Remember the tie? And we lined up all of the red states, that is those that went for George W. Bush, all the blue states, those that went for Al Gore. And we were mindful that some of those states were red by 7,000 votes or blue by 5,000 votes. Florida by 500 votes became a red state. But nonetheless, we asked a whole lot of values and behavioral questions. And then what we did was we cross-tabulated that data by if you live in a red state or live in a blue state. And it was stark. You were twice as likely to be pro-life in a red state than you were in a blue state. I remember this number very well. 61% of the voters that lived in red states said, I carry a gun or possess a firearm. It was 35% in the blue states. Just to mix it up a little bit, how do you define God in your life? Is God the all-knowing, the all-present force in your life and in the world who governs every detail? Or is God the watchmaker, the creator who just set things in motion and then, like a watch, leaves everything else up to the mechanics and the science? You were twice as likely to believe that God was a watchmaker just by living in a blue state than a red, and so on down the line. And I remember this got an enormous amount of play in the news media. And of course, I think it helped set the table for the 2004 elections, which, as you know, between George W. Bush and John Kerry was very tight and ultimately came down to about 60,000 votes in the state of Ohio that ultimately put George W. Bush over the top. But here we are, we're 18 years later, and what we've discovered is not simply a red state, blue state difference, but a red state, blue state antagonism. And now if we were to ask, and I believe we should, about what constitutes reality, what constitutes fake news, what constitutes the Constitution, what doesn't constitute the Constitution. if we got down to real brass tacks, even beyond the questions we asked 18 years ago, that we would find that, again, this artificial construct, because, you know, there's liberals that live in red states, conservatives that live in blue states. But the bottom line is there's an antagonism, a real antagonism. And as we've kind of asked before, is this healable? Is this something we want to heal? Is there a national community, a common set of values? Is the Constitution relevant? Is it needed? Are we going to stay together, or are we not going to stay together? Are these differences so fundamental that we've reached a point of no return?
I assume that I take a first stab at that.
Yeah, or we can end the podcast right now. Just give me the last word. I'm kidding.
I think we can. Will we is the question. Why can we heal it? Or how can we heal it is the most important question. You know, I was just thinking this morning, I was going over in my head and I was saying, and this line aligns perfectly in some regards with what you're saying. I was thinking, I've heard from people your age and older, and I've read about there used to be in America where people said, I disagree with you, but I believe in your freedom to believe what you believe. I support your freedom, you know, viewpoints and freedom of speech, and even beyond freedom of speech. I mean, probably even the Second Amendment, right to privacy, and all of those really staple freedoms that we as a nation formed by saying that we were granted by God or by nature, whether you believed in the watchmaker God or the intervening God, there was a God, and whatever the entity was in terms of its makeup, it still granted us these freedoms. And so there was an America that said, I'll disagree with you, but I will fight for your right to believe in that and to exercise that. But that, I think we are at a point right now where that has been thrown out the window and it is in free fall. And I don't know how high the skyscraper is before it splatters to the ground. I hope it's really, 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 really high, higher than the moon, so that we can avoid that splattering effect. But it seems to be that is out of the window. The quintessential, I would say, another quintessential American belief was live and let live. And that is gone. That there has always been a divide in this country of urban versus rural. Mm-hmm. And that's playing out still to this point. You know, that was the divide between the anti-federalists and the federalists, the Jeffersonians and the Hamiltonians, the populism versus the mercantilism, and the agrarian versus the cosmopolitan. And the data that you cited from that study in 2003 is largely still showing that we have that, but there's an extremism. And I'm going to be fair that in saying that there's an extremism on both sides, but if we are to heal, to go back to your question, we need to understand that these values are shaped by environment. Now, I know you said, for example, there are a lot of Democrats who live in red states, but there are a lot of people in red states who have lived in red states for generations, and their environment and their lifestyle has shaped their living. And you cannot expect to take a coastal mentality of big cities from Seattle down to Los Angeles and from Boston down to Miami and say we are going to make that the de facto culture from sea to sea, from coast to coast, and all the way down the Mississippi, and vice versa. So it's a big country. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of different geographical factors and environments that shape these values and philosophies. And we need to understand that you have to live and let live. Otherwise, are we really going to go to war? I mean, is the essence of democracy to be, let's get that 50.5% or that 51% and ram down our agenda, ram it down the throats of the opposition? That is what we've become. And that it will break this country. There's no question about it. The question is when will the dam break?
Okay. So unfortunately, the political party structure in this country has become beholden to this antagonism in such a way that it's outmoded. So I may run in my district and be able to function well in my district, whether my district is 100, you know, is 70% Democrat. I'm running as a Democrat, 70% Republican, and I'm running as a Republican, but I can still serve my district. The problem is when I go to Washington and the party leadership says, we got to line you up. You've got to vote our way. And our way is, regardless of whether you agree with the Democrats or not, our way is to oppose. Whether you agree with the Republicans or not, our way is to oppose. And my loyalty then becomes both to the people of my district, to a lesser degree, my conscience, to a great degree, what the party leadership wants. And so there is a conflict, and that ruins, I think, the behavior of some very good people that we send to Congress or to state legislatures. I think the problem is that it's very hard to speak for the national community. Look at both parties. On the Republican side, Donald Trump has 95% support of self-identified Republicans. Right now, the folks who genuinely don't have a home are moderate Republicans, or those over the last 10 years that we've seen purged because they've crossed the aisle, that they've agreed to sit down with Democrats and to compromise. By the same token, you've got a hard push from the left as well on the Democratic side, although there seems to be kind of a recognition that Joe Biden is president. We're going to maintain some semblance of party unity, force him to the left, but some semblance of party unity in the interests of holding on to what limited power that we have. Bottom line here is that I think we're both in agreement that that we need to get together, led by the President of the United States and the leaders of Congress. And this is just in terms of healing wounds and making policy and starting all over again and saying, here are the common principles upon which we agree. We could start with the preamble of the Constitution, but we then have to move to what will play out in favor of keeping that national community. Now, you might argue, well, why do we need a national community? I mean, can't each state be allowed to govern its own people and its own rules? Well, what we've seen is, and this is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, that there can be some unfairness. There can be unequal protection under the Constitution. Having states' rights can play out not in the favor of Black Americans. And so it's intertwined. Who are we as a country, and how can we be fair to every citizen in this country? And that's the huge disagreement that we have, but I really do fear, and it's a real fear, that our institutions can simply fall apart, and that the national government just simply becomes pockets for special interests.
Absolutely. And the overriding theme of the last 120 years has been centralization. And I think this is the result of centralization. And I've asked this question many times, and I think it's more pressing than ever. Do we continue further down centralization? After we've seen where we came from and where we are today, is further centralization the answer? I think it's a rhetorical question based on everything that I've said and you said. Remember, this, as you've alluded to, this country was built on federalism. And federalism was the relationship between the federal government and state governments. And, you know, the 10th Amendment, the states' rights, is funny because it depends on who's in power. People on the left or Democrats love to cite it when it works to their advantage. And people on the right and conservatives love to cite it when it works to their advantage. And that's been the history. That was the case in the 19th century. It wasn't just an old Dixie kind of thing, you know, an old slavery kind of thing. I mean, going back to the very beginnings of the nation, Massachusetts threatened to secede from the country, from the Union. And this was a tradition. And it's a balance of power. And so if you talk about racism and the horrors of Jim Crow and the KKK and, the old agricultural sharecropping system that still held down Black people, African Americans, the beauty of this country was that, well, you can vote with your feet, right? So even if your state doesn't have your best interest, you can go somewhere and look at what they did with the Great Migration. Millions of African Americans said, well, the land of hope, the land of the free is in the North. And they went from being sharecroppers to working in factories and having good pay. Now, I'm not saying that overnight, they achieved the American dream, but they got a lot closer and they achieved middle class status a lot quicker than they did. So it's having that balance of power. And I think because I said this century and one score has been an overt march towards centralization, the only answer is to roll back and go back to the concept of a laboratory of democracy. 50 states, each having, and I'm not saying make it all anarchy and let them all just do what they want, but start rolling back the centralization and the controls of micromanaging every aspect of our life. I mean, we understand in corporations, we've come to learn with the turn of the century that micromanaging isn't good. Well, if it's not good for massive corporations, it's probably not good for government. So roll it back. Let there be a loop of feedback and see what works, and people will realign. People will go to where their values are. And will it be a utopia? Never. We have to stop with that excuse, that rebuttal to an argument. Well, that sounds utopian. No, nothing's utopian. The question is, which system sucks the least? And I think the system that I'm describing may, especially in the 21st century, may work a little bit better because it's more dynamic and more flexible. I'll just say one more thing. The harbinger of our time is censorship and cancel culture. And that is another byproduct of the centralization and the desire to dominate and control and force feed a narrative. And if we continue to go down that road, I don't think any of us are really prepared for what that looks like, because I can see it very clearly. That will pit brother against brother. It will pit neighbor against neighbor. And it could likely lead to some form of national suicide.
So I'm going to leave on this note on agreeing with you on that. I'm not ready to go with the decentralization model. I do agree that the states are the laboratory for democracy, but I also think that there has to be some form of national set of values, some sort of guiding light and guiding hand that that binds everyone together. But with that said, at this point, what I'd like to do is announce that we will have our first podcast guest in September. Details to follow, but Parag Khanna, who is a favorite author of mine, who has written a number of books about the future, is now coming out with a book called Move. And it's about how millennials actually, as I've written over a decade ago, are actually global citizens and actually borderless to a large degree. We'll go wherever the opportunities are, and the opportunities are boundless geographically. I'll have more about that, but you may want to check him out. Parag, P-A-R-A-G, Khanna, K-H-A-N-N-A. He'll be our first guest sometime in September, and we'll talk about that then. A lot of what you just said about the ability, the freedom to move, you know, could be the antidote to, you know, a number of economic and political injustices. And so I think that's it for this week. Always good to talk to you.
Same here. Let me just close with a question. If we're going to have a national community, and many of us are very concerned and frustrated and angry with what we have in Washington, D.C., can we really trust that leadership, or can regions and states point to a direction? It's just a question to ponder over the weekend.
Okay, I'm pondering.
Me too.
Have a good week.